Life can get pretty complicated. In the Simply Practically Human podcast, Mark Lebusque talks to incredible humans to see the way forward more clearly through the complexity in the world and in our heads. Let's get ready to thrive.
Hey, g'day there, fellow humans. Mark Lebusque here for another edition of the Simply Practically Human podcast. And after the last one, I've got a bit self-indulgent again. Had some pretty interesting reviews on it. Some people coming back and saying, love the way that you don't sugarcoat your message and say it as you see it. And it's one thing that they're saying they don't get a lot of in their workplaces these days. So I had five more questions come at me. So I'm going to have another crack today at five questions. This might become a bit of a regular thing. If you've got a bit of a contentious issue or a question or something related to leadership or the workplace or yourself or, I don't know, like today, someone who's stealing your good ideas or always wanting to be in the photo, flick through some questions to me. You can get me on LinkedIn, message me on LinkedIn if you like. You can message me on Insta or wherever else you want to message me, and I'll give it a crack. So five more questions today, five curious humans wanting to know a little bit more about particular topics. And I think this first one's an absolute ripper. It comes from Michelle. We talk about workplaces being like a family unit, and we know we're like a family. Now, the question that Michelle poses is this a misguided attempt to characterize a working environment with support, fun, trust, and a positive challenge, or a big red flag? So, Michelle, what a great question. What great curiosity. So let me give this one a crack. What comes to mind for me straight away are some words that were shared with me about 10 years ago, and our ability to both practice relentless optimism and brutal realism. So, you know, I think there's a bit of unicorns and rainbows in this. We're one big happy family at work, and, you know, we're like a family, and you'll say the name, insert the name. This is the, if it's my business, this is the Mark Lebusque family. Now, the relentless optimism and the unicorns and rainbows sort of have you, I think, lulled into a false sense of security that every family unit or most family units get on really well together. And all of those things that Michelle mentioned, support, fun, trust, the positive challenge that comes with it, I reckon are all a bit of a smokescreen, because if you look at the other side of it, the brutal realism is that, and you may be able to relate to this because I certainly can, that whilst family units can have different levels of connection and that sense of belonging and whatever else, some people tend to find that the family unit is, in a brutally realistic way, quite dysfunctional. And, you know, at some point in time, you could be talking to them and then you're not, and you're keeping secrets, and you may be isolating yourself or others. There could be low levels of trust, depending upon what happened when you were younger or what happened during your teenage years, whatever it might be. So I guess this idea of characterizing a work environment as a family, one of the things I'd say to you, Michelle, and to others who are listening, who perhaps roll this line out a bit, is when you hear it, have a conversation about it and just dig into that a bit further, or get above it and then have a conversation around. So let's have a look at it from a few different perspectives. Is it always supportive? Is it always fun? Is there always that feeling of trust and that we're challenging each other in a positive way? Is it really a family? Do we want it to be a family? Do we want it to be something else? Because I think it's a bit of a throwaway line. I think it's sprinkling the old fairy dust out to create some sort of unreal world or unreal environment that families as units are close and supportive and they have fun and they do all these things, when I'd hazard a guess that some of the people that are even saying this may well be saying it because their family that they're actually in, their biological family, may not be showing any of those characteristics. So I think there's a few things in this one. I think the first one, I just said it before, is when people start to throw it out there as a throwaway line, we're like family here, Don't just look past it. I'd suggest that you start a conversation around, so what is it that you observe in here that would say we're a family? What is a family? And what are some of the things that we're doing that would suggest that we're not really a family? Or we are a family? And if a family can have its ups and downs, like a workplace can have its ups and downs, do we behave in the same way in our work family that we do with our biological family? And I think the answer to that will be no. So there's a few things here that set off the red flags for me. One is that it's just a throwaway line. It's just one of those lines that gets thrown in, like when you say, I don't trust someone, or they don't communicate well, or whatever it might be. The important thing here, Michelle, is to dig underneath it. And don't get caught up in the unicorns and rainbows and the fairy dust. And don't allow people just to throw these lines out there. But then ask the question, what do you mean by family? And have that conversation. I've seen a lot of families that if you're in the workplace, you say, I don't think I really want to be like that family. So just be careful that you're not using this as some sort of nice way to represent how you think or what you'd like it to be, when perhaps underneath that in the workplace, it's not quite the functional family that you're trying to make it out to be. And the brutal realism of it is that it's quite dysfunctional, but we don't really want to upset the brothers and sisters and the parents and the aunties and the uncles by having the conversations that we need to have. The second question is from Andy, and it's about first impressions. And this is something, if you've listened to my podcasts with my guests, the first question I ask them is about their first impressions of me, and I'll share my first impressions of them. And the reason that I do that is that we are judgmental. And even if you say you don't, you do, because we're hardwired to make judgment. We're looking for anything that we may consider to be either dangerous for us or safe for us. Another reason we're judging and we're tapping into our little, what I'm going to call our little judgment file in our head, is we're looking to conserve energy and brain power by using some of our past experiences. Perhaps someone reminds you of somebody, they look like them, they sound like them. Maybe they've got the same sort of job as them. Maybe they're the second child, maybe they're the middle child, the old middle child syndrome. But we use a lot of this information that impacts on our first impression. So Andy's question is about how helpful or harmful can first impressions be? And where does gut feel come in? So let me go with the first one. How helpful or harmful can they be? Well, I think it comes back to, I've talked about this before, Andy, it comes back to intention. And what are the intentions of your first impressions, in brackets, your judgment? Are they coming from a place of being pure, or is there some evil to them? And I think that will start to determine whether they're helpful for you or harmful for you. You see that there are times when we want to just filter in the information that will suit the story that we want to create about a person or a company or a public sector, private sector, whatever it might be, a position in an organization, a department in an organization. And that'll continue to serve our purpose, but it may well be harmful because we're not open to what may well be the truth. We may only be open to one truth, which is the truth that we've created over many, many years of the way that we've believed things. So for instance, I think about, we do an activity in my program called Judging Mark, where I get judged on 5 very random things, and people will say that they are very much impacted on a few things. One is appearance. One is their own experience. One could be their preference, what they see in my body language, how they hear me speak, and even can be based upon the nature of the work that I do. So the good side of it is that we're trying to make sense of the person or the situation. So we're sort of keep ourselves a little bit open. We'll make a judgment, but then what I'll do is practice the two A's, awareness. is that impression, is that judgment helpful to me and the other person? Or is it harmful to me or the other person? And you'll get a sense with your gut feel on those things. So if it's harmful, I think you need to practice the second A, which is adjustment, and start to adjust your story, your belief, and your behavior, because I've seen on many occasions that people have either been tripped up by their first impression because they've tapped back into that little box in their brain that's got all of these previous judgments and historical judgments in it. And the bad side of that is they've misread the situation totally. They've misread the situation. They've misread the person. And the big one on that's on appearance. When people have judged me over 10 years, when you look at my initial headshot I had taken, which is actually the banner for this podcast, along with a current photo, well, their judgment of me is totally different. In fact, when I show the photo today from 10 years ago, people have to second guess it. And some people say, is that you? Or that can't be you. But their judgment of me then and their first impression of me then and their first impression of me now is very different. So they can be helpful when they're well-intended. They can be harmful when they're not so well-intended. And gut feel comes right into it, because even for those who say they're very logical people, and I have them in the room, or I don't judge, I don't make judgment, I don't go with my gut, I need more data before I can make judgment and I can do this and I can do that. Well, sorry to disappoint you, but most of us, if not all of us, maybe not those that are really robotic, they fire in the gut first. We will feel something first before we think something. And it might just be a millisecond between the two, but gut feel comes into it in a big way. I don't know how often someone has said, I should have gone with my gut feel, but they got dragged back up into that idiot box in their head and tried to be logical and go through some sort of frigging algorithm in their head, knowing full well that their gut was saying, hey, I don't think you're going down the right path. And they went down that wrong path. And then they said, oh shit, I should have gone with my gut. So gut feel comes into it in a big way, Andy. The big challenge then is to try and line that up with that intention. And then secondly, combat and fight that huge desire to go up into your head and sort of try and sort through it in some sort of spreadsheet or algorithm or some other way. So my advice here to finish up would be, don't go around saying you don't make judgment and you don't go into the first impression space, because we all do, but be really, really conscious of the intention and the story that's coming up for you when you are making that judgment, particularly when it could be harmful for you. The next question is from Catherine. I think this is a brilliant question, because I've been through this myself, and I'll share a bit of a story on how it happened, and maybe this will help you if you're a little bit stuck here. So Catherine's saying, look, I've been keen to explore other options in my workplace, other departments to go and work in, but I don't know how to approach this because I'm worried that my manager won't like my idea or support it or me. What can I do, Mark? So there's a few ways to go about this. There's a safer way, and there's perhaps one another way, Catherine, that might not feel safe, but I'm going to say that when I took the not so safe way, it helped me to get to where I am today. I guess the safer way is to start having some informal conversations, perhaps through your one-to-ones if you're having them. If your boss is a good boss, they should be having one-to-ones with you. And as part of that, you should be having conversations about your professional development plan, your career plan. And if you're not, I think the first step in that is to at least get your boss to start to engage in some of those conversations, perhaps once every 3 months, I think is a way to do it. I think the second thing is you need to be really, really clear about why you're looking to explore some other options, because as a human being, your boss may well be, even though they might say it, they may be thinking, well, what have I done? You know, what sort of light does that shine on to me in front of my peers and perhaps my boss and even the HR group if all of a sudden somebody who's considered a an asset to the organization and doing a good job wants to move somewhere else. So there's going to be potentially a little bit of a concern coming from the other way. So you'll need to reassure your manager that you've done some real work behind this to understand why you want to move. Now, if it's because you're really pissed off at your job and you hate it and you're not happy with your manager, that's a whole different conversation. But I think allaying the fears for your manager that it's all about them, even if it's not, and if it isn't about them, allay those fears for them, but make it really clear to them why you're looking at this. And it could well be for a few reasons. It could be about broadening your technical skill set, but it also might be about you saying, look, I want to actually apply some more of those transferable human skills I've built, and there's just some other areas of the business that I'd like to explore and experiment that in. So I think that's something you got to think about first, is to get some buy-in from your manager. Now, if you've got that and you get the sign-off from your manager, the other thing would be is to get them to be a bit of a sponsor for you, to be having conversations with the types of people in the areas where you want to move to. I'm also going to suggest that they'd be good conversations to be having already. Not to say I'm looking for a job, but just to get an understanding of why did that person work in that role in that area, so you can get a sense of, does that align with some of my beliefs and the way that I'm thinking at the moment? Now, here's the not so safe way to do it, perhaps a risky way. And this was what I did for my very last professional development plan. I think they called them PDPs or something like that, or career development plans, CDPs. There was always an acronym for something. I remember sitting down and I thought it was like a really good process. It was very simple to fill out. It was very easily understandable. For the first time in my career, and I'd say that's a career of 25 years, I actually honestly wrote down on that professional development plan what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it wasn't what I was doing at that particular time. It was totally in another area of the organization. It was aligned to some conversations and some exploration I'd been having with myself and others for quite some time. But I still remember feeling the butterflies continuing to flutter at an extreme rate in my guts when I hit the button on that, and very, very quickly got a phone call back from someone who received it going, what the bloody hell are you doing? So I think the first step is, in the not so safe way, is to be honest with yourself and ask yourself this question, what do I want to be when I grow up? So I did that. There was a little bit of conjecture. There was some advice given to me that, you know, you're taking a sideways step. You're stepping out of a role that you're doing really well in, and there could be a great future for you in that area. Why would you do this? It's a bit of a dead end for you. You know, you've got 40 people reporting to you now, and you're not going to have any. All of those sorts of things that I think are more aligned to what the crazy idea of what success is in organizational life is, that you're climbing up the ladder further and further. Every rung you get higher is success. The more people you have to look after is success. The more money you're earning is success. And the more rewards that come from hanging around, let's say, those people near the top. But what if you don't want that? So first things first, Catherine, I'd say to do the work of you to start with. Get outside of your head and be honest with yourself, because if it's because you're not happy in your role, well, it doesn't matter how much money you're earning, I don't think, because I know a lot of miserably rich people, I've coached a few, that you need to start to have a real conversation with yourself. So once you are clear, you can then have a conversation with your manager and encourage them to help further conversations into the organization and be able to hold your nerve and don't get romanced in all of the platitudes that come your way when people say you're doing an amazing job and you're going to be next in line and why would you do this? Because if you want to make the move, and if it's not just about the traditional things that got us going in moving through an organization, as I said, moving up the hierarchy, more money, bigger office, if office is still, car parks and all those things, and have the real conversation. Now, having done that, I know what happened to me. I went from being a sales director into the HR department and then ultimately got to do the sorts of things that I do today in my business, which is now 10 years old, which is coach people, facilitate conversations, bring people together that perhaps are showing a bit of dysfunction and helping them to work through that. And I got to practice it and I got to find out that not only did I love it, but I was pretty bloody good at it. That's me blowing some smoke up my ass. But ultimately, it gave me the confidence to go and make the next step, which was to step out and do my own thing. And I don't think I've looked back. And that came, I think, from the moment when I hit that button on that professional development plan, a little bit, I guess, apprehensively, because if you're not feeling some sort of discomfort, you're not stepping into your leadership, as I've said before, and you're not being true to yourself. So good luck with it, Catherine. Have a crack, and would love to hear how you get on. Here's an old chestnut that Denise brings up, which I'm sure many of you can relate to this, because these people exist. And unfortunately, it can be called playing the politics and managing up and positioning yourself and all this stuff. But let's just get to what it is. People taking credit for the great work that others do. So the comment from Denise is, someone keeps taking credit for my work. How should I approach this? So the first thing is, and I've said this a million times before in these, get yourself a mirror, have a look into it, and work out your part in the mess. Now, if somebody is continuing to take credit for your work, it could well be that you're a pushover and they've got you to a place and your predictability is that you get a bit pissed off, but you don't do anything about it and it becomes a repetitive cycle. So first things first, Denise, what are you doing that contributes to the place you find yourself in? It's always very easy to say that the other person's the culprit. And in this situation, they do own some of that blame, if you want to call it. I'm getting a sense there's a bit of blame here. But what are you doing to allow it to happen? So have that conversation with yourself first. Get above it, understand what you're doing, and start to look at how you can change your behavior very, very subtly, not to go from zero to 100 straight away. But then I'm starting to think about, what can you now start to do to overturn this and overcome this? Because you'll need to get on the front foot. The first place to start at is, I'd have a bit of fun with it. I remember when we used to get consultants, and I am one of these now, coming into our organisation, some of these young, shiny-faced folk just out of college, and they send them in to do great work. And I remember at one stage someone asking me about a little pack that I'd put together and whether they could have a copy of it, and I said no. And they're like, well, why? And I said, because you're going to put your frigging company logo in the bottom right-hand corner and you're going to make it out as if it's your own, because I've seen it happen 100 times before. So maybe have a bit of fun and say, hey, are you thinking about becoming a consultant? Because this is where you go into the conversation, because some behaviours I'm observing are very consultant-like. It appears like we have a conversation, you grab hold of an idea of mine and then you go and present it as your own, with your name at the bottom of the email, and here's how it makes me feel. So you need to have a conversation with that person one-to-one about how you're feeling, and then perhaps ask them why they do it. If it's a repeating pattern, and it feels to me a bit like this one is, if it's a repeating pattern, ask them why. Get curious with them. Don't get furious with them straight away. Get curious and ask them, why are you doing this? Because it would actually be in your interest to understand and know why someone might do it, just in case you experience it again along the way. You can at least have a little bit of empathy for that person. Doesn't mean that you're going to accept it, but you can empathize with them, understand where they're coming from. And if you can, and there's enough maturities to work through that. It may even well be at the back end of this that you two could work together with coming together with some different ideas and come up with better ideas, better work by having the conversation. But the great challenge right now is, if you're not having the conversation because you're a pushover, you're actually just setting yourself up to be continually used by these sorts of people, because they'll understand your predictability. And I'm not sure, it doesn't sit in, say, whether it was at your level, below your level, above your level. But at the end of the day, that shouldn't matter, because they're a human being too, and you need to have the conversation. And then I say what I call the velvet sledgehammer line to someone like that. And I have a T-shirt that I wear with great pride. One of my 30 or so I've got with the little slogans on them, and maybe just to remind this person that you don't always have to be in the photo. Now, you can extend that by saying, what if you at times were the one taking the photo and allowing other people to receive the acknowledgement, appreciation, and credit for the work they've done? Because these sorts of people who do this, they don't understand that at some point in time, they're going to disappear up their own backside because no one's going to want to work with them. No one's going to want to share anything with them because they continue to be the one who wants to be in the front row of the camera shot rather than the other side taking the photo. So Denise, good luck with it. Have some fun, be a bit cheeky, but also do some work on yourself. And I bet you there's a repetitive behavior here that goes on with you that could be from a long way back. Perhaps you just find it difficult to speak up on behalf of yourself because you're worried that that person might be a bit upset. But my sense is you're more upset than they are. And the last question for this one is from Harrison, and it's all about the term that I hate, which is work-life balance. I call it life design, but I'm going to use that term because this is what Harrison used. Harrison says his work-life balance is off the rails because I can't say no and fear if I do, I'll be next to go, next in line for the chopping block. Have you got any advice, Mark? So the first bit of advice is change the terminology from work-life balance to life design. And I say that very deliberately. Work is part of your life, Harrison, and it's an important part of your life. And for all of these people that are trying to create some sort of falsehood that they are separate, they're not. And I think this is one of the great challenges with this one is that we're trying to say there's work and then we have a life, but they're all intertwined. So thinking about it as life design, and then the thing I'd have a chat to you about is do a bit of an audit on yourself, on your life design, and get a bit of a sense of what it's looking like. Like, it doesn't have to be absolutely accurate, but as accurate as it can be, looking at things like self-time, family time, friends time, paid and unpaid work time, sleep time, community time, what I call I don't know time, when you don't know what you're doing, but you were doing something, which I think is a bit of chill out time at times. Do that for a couple of weeks, and then rather than making a statement that my work-life balance and my life design is off the rails, you'll have some data points to start with, and then you can start to make some decisions first and then conversations perhaps with yourself and others about, well, what does it really look like? Is it really off the rails? Is it just that I feel quite stressed now? And how does that then roll up into me not being able to say no? And what are the things I can't say no to? So this is important as well. What can't you say no to? Who can't you say no to, which is even more important? Is it to the people, if you're a manager, that report to you? Is it to your peers? Is it to your manager? And then what are the impacts that's having on your life design? So how does that impact on you getting self-time or family time or maybe some time in the community? Or is it keeping you awake at night so your sleep's being affected? And then the other thing that I suggest you look at is what I call your perspective line. And this idea of what's most important to you, Harrison, what's moderately important and what's least important, and be really honest in this thing. Look at five in each of those boxes and then line that up next to your 2-week audit on your life design and then see how true or otherwise that is. And then you might have to start making some courageous decisions about, like, I'm going to need to do something here. Because sure as hell, if this is like you say it is, it's not just going to be confined to work. It's going to be confined across your life. That's why we call it life design. And not just you, but others will be feeling the brunt of what's going on. And the other thing for you to think about here is, so what if you're the next to go? Because I get a bit of a sense that you're not overly happy. And why stay somewhere where you're not happy? I know there's the financial side of it, but if you go out and back yourself, dust off your resume, start looking at both your technical and your human skills and what you can bring in other areas, and be really bold having conversations with potential new employers about the importance of life design to you and how important do they see it, you just might find that you actually find a fit where your life design can be back on the rails, whatever that means, and you can be living a life well-designed. So do the audit. And just on the thing of not being able to say no, you don't have to say those two letters, no, to say no. There are a whole lot of different ways to say that. So maybe your predictability of not being able to say no and saying yes to everything, you might want to start saying something like, what would you like me not to do if you want me to take that on as well? And see what sort of reaction you get to that. But again, a bit like I said with Denise, you need to do a bit of soul searching and mirror gazing for yourself to see what your contribution to the mess is that you find yourself in. So there we go, folks. Workplaces as families, first impressions, career options that are outside of what I'm doing today, someone stealing my good work and always being in the photo, and my work-life balance is up to shit, or my life design is up to shit. These are things that are on people's minds today, on humans' minds, and I get the good opportunity to grab those questions and with very, very little research, just me waffling on, give you the answers and maybe some perspective to think about. Hey, if you loved this one, why not rate it 5 stars and tell us why? Maybe it's something that you're working on right now and these 5 humans have helped you to crack through it. If you liked it, share it with your friends. Maybe you're having some conversations about these things right now. You can play it in a group meeting because most, 63% of times in meeting they say it's futile. So maybe just make it a bit less futile and listen to this and then have a conversation about it. And if you've got questions, as I said, DM me, send them through on LinkedIn. The more challenging and contentious, the better. Or send them through to me on email at mark@marklebus.com. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.